This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight we'll be hearing the second part of my interview with Walter Bosley. Of course, if you're a Patreon, you already heard this whole thing, plus the extra bit that we did afterwards. But if you did not hear the whole thing, here is part two. So if you missed part one, you probably want to go listen to that first. You can find it at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And we're also doing, for anyone who doesn't realize that we do more than one show a week, the show airs on WVBR and Dark Matter Radio, but there's a bunch of podcasts during the week. There's two or three shows a week usually, including this one. And we're doing a series that doesn't sound like it's going to be very exciting. It's on some, it's sort of like redefining psychological terms. Sounds kind of dry, except it's not. This paper that was published in a psychological journal did a really good job of sort of pulling the pins out of some of the assumptions of the materialist paradigm and clarifying some of the stuff that gets thrown around terminology-wise in the paranormal as well as psychology. So it spawned some very interesting conversations. I mean, it deals with everything from consciousness to perception to things like lie detector tests and hypnosis and all of this stuff. There's like 50 terms. We covered 20 of them in the episode that is up right now. It's going to be at least a three-part interview, conversation, roundtable. I'm pointing it out because I don't want people to think it's going to be something dry, because it's not. It's actually very, very interesting and very relevant to the type of subjects we talk about here. I'd also like to give a shout-out to Aaron Gullius. If you haven't checked it out, he has a new podcast entitled The Saucer Life. Go check that out, because it is excellent and deals with like the history of different contact experiences throughout the years. So if you liked our series with him and Mike Cleland on UFO history, check out The Saucer Life. It's on iTunes and I'm sure other places as well. I got it from iTunes. So, and we have a new t-shirt design thanks to Jeff Ritzman. It's kind of a ghost ship sort of thing. So you can check that out in the store at wheredidtheroadgo.com. All right, without any further ado, here is the second part of my conversation with Walter Bosley.
So let's get, well, first of all, before, I do want to get into Crowley, but let's get into Hecate. Okay. Why Hecate?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's what I asked initially. Okay, so if we've got this Hecate stuff going on, then what we have is somebody into very dark black magic witchcraft, right? That's, mm-hmm. of course, you know, the question in my mind. That's what I thought. And the more I learned about Hecate, the complete picture, I learned that she's the goddess of witches like any other god or goddess is just adopted by a group because they like certain attributes, okay? I don't see Hecate as the goddess of witches because she thinks they're a bunch of cool people that are, they're really got her, you know, pegged and understand her. Hecate is like electricity. Now, electricity can do great and wonderful things. It can also be deadly if mishandled.
Sure.
So the way I see it is the stuff the witches do involving Hecate and all their Hecate association, it's very quaint. But it by no means represents the whole picture of Hecate. And I would dare say that, you know, she likely disapproves of a lot of the crap done in her name by some of these people. But why Hecate? Because she is the goddess at the gates of the underworld. In other words, when you pass into death and you're passing into the afterlife, you go through the underworld. She's the goddess of, you know, that experience of that passage. So naturally, you know, we're dealing with seven deaths. We're dealing with, you know, all the symbolism related to that. Also, there is the possible theme that these seven deaths were sacrifices committed to venerate the opening of the Panama Canal, which was being celebrated in California at that time with the Pan Pacific Exposition. There was the one in San Francisco and then the one in San Diego. And what this did was, you know, the Panama Canal would open up industry. It would open up particularly agricultural industry, okay? Mm-hmm. And one of the big themes of the California expositions, of course, was our California agriculture. And in the mix of agriculture, you have the mythology involving Persephone and Ceres, okay? And Ceres being her mother, and is a goddess of agriculture, and is the one who asked Hecate when Persephone was abducted into the underworld, okay, by Pluto, Hephaestus, or whatever the version you're reading. Persephone's mother went to Hecate and beseeched her to go into the underworld and bring her daughter back. So Hecate goes into the underworld, her realm, with her two torches, and of course finds Persephone. And what happens is Persephone, of course, eats the pomegranate seeds, so now she's stuck. She has to spend half the year in the underworld and the other half of the year up in the living world. Right. Well, this, of course, is involved in the symbolism of, life renewing itself, right, with the seasons and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's all connected with agriculture. And, of course, that brings us back to the celebration of the Panama Canal, what that was going to do, okay, for industry and particularly the agricultural industry. And at that time, the San Bernardino Valley was growing as the capital of the citrus industry in the United States at that time, more so than Florida. So here you have, in the Inland Empire, the San Bernardino Valley in particular, here you have all these people where the very lifeblood of their valley, their lives, their industry, is tied in with agriculture, okay? You know, the railroad was here greatly because of that and contributing to it. So therefore, you have a lot of Persephone symbolism in this whole mystery, and we go into it, you know, in the book. And where you have Persephone, you have Hecate. And that's another angle. So you have the whole underworld, the death, you've got the whole agricultural thing that I just laid out, and both of these involve Hecate. And you know, there you have it. There's two big examples, potential answers to the question, why Hecate? But it's even, of course, bigger than that. And the books, all three of the books go into that.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about Crowley. Okay. And how Crowley figures into all this.
Well, it's a small role, however. I think it had a major impact on him and his work. Aleister Crowley was doing his U.S. tour where he came west and, you know, then headed down to San Diego, and he met Catherine Tinsley, I believe, at that time, and then, you know, went back east. And this is that trip that greatly mirrors the itinerary that Harry Houdini also was taking at the time. And because of the Mexican War going on, all passenger railroad traffic was being diverted from the southernmost routes to the next one north. Okay, so instead of going along where, if you've ever driven along Highway 10 from California into Texas, you'll know you're going through, you know, the more southern parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and of course, you know, you get into West Texas. This follows greatly where the railroad followed along the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, because of the Mexican War and all the stuff going on, the skirmishes, what they did was they diverted all the passenger traffic, as I said, north. And if you were going from California to the East Coast, or you were coming from the East Coast to anywhere in Southern California, you had to go through San Bernardino, because San Bernardino was, and for many, many decades, and still to some extent, a major railroad hub in the southwestern United States, and in California in particular, okay? Now, we know that Crowley was in California in the fall of 1915, sorry. And I went to the archives, the local railroad archives, Southern Pacific, I believe, here in San Bernardino at our historical train station here. And I looked at the actual, you know, records of the showing how they had to divert the passenger traffic because they didn't want to have passengers on the southern routes in case, you know, skirmishes in the Mexican War happened. Mm-hmm. And the historian there confirmed to me that if Aleister Crowley, anybody, had come from San Diego to head east on the train through the American Southwest, okay, at that time in 1915, he confirmed that he absolutely would have had to pass through San Bernardino during that time. So I was able to, that this isn't just a theory of mine, I was able to demonstrate and get confirmed by the railroad historian himself and their records. That now, he wasn't able to show me a ticket. Here's where, this is the day, Aleister Crowley. We got it narrowed down based on Crowley's itinerary, knowing when he passed through certain points in Arizona and after leaving San Diego. I'm able to narrow it down to a certain stretch of, I think, 3 or 4 days that he would have had to have passed through San Bernardino. And we don't know if he stayed overnight or if he just, you know, disembarked the San Diego train and got on the train bound east that would take him through Arizona, northern Arizona, through Flagstaff, past the Grand Canyon and all that. Mm-hmm. But he did have to pass through San Bernardino in November of 1915 when stuff was going on. Now, some people think, well, he had to have been the guy that poisoned the children. Well, no, when you look at the details, where the children were poisoned and, you know, the days, no, Crowley was not here when that happened. However,
Not only does that seem to be Crowley's MO either.
Thank you. I've had several people who want to argue with me and bicker over Crowley was a baby killer, and he definitely would have been the. I have a very good friend, a close research associate, who insists to me that I've got it all wrong, that Aleister Crowley was the mastermind behind these deaths that I believe are serial murders, and that he passed through to make sure everything was going right, and he was the one behind all these deaths. And I just shake my head because, you know, like Hecate, the more I learned about Crowley, the less I suspected him of any wrongdoing. As a matter of fact, I think his novel Moonchild was greatly influenced and is partially based on what he knew about what was going on in San Bernardino at that time. I do think Crowley learned about whatever nefarious thing was going on here at the time. I am convinced he learned about it through his sources, and I conclude that he would have seriously disapproved of it.
Yeah.
And I think that it went into his novel Moonchild. Now, somebody argued, well, that book wasn't published until Yeah, it wasn't published until I think 11 years after he finished it, but it was written within 18 months after he passed through San Bernardino. I think it was that novel is partially based on what was going on here in San Bernardino between a couple factions and, you know, naturally other experiences and groups and things he knew about that, you know, was going on in Europe also. But the book goes into that. Empire of the Wheel, the first book, goes into better detail than I can here. I'm probably not doing my own book a good service here.
Well, Crowley is one of those people where, yeah, he did some bad stuff here and there, but overall, he didn't seem to be a really bad guy. It kind of takes, you got to kind of pick and take out of what he did, and really look at him, because he liked people thinking he was this
exactly
beast, this, you know, this monster, because he got a kick out of their ignorance.
Oh, of course, yeah, he enjoyed, you know, setting himself up as the big bugaboo. And there's just people out there that still, they read the propaganda and they read stuff that's simply not true. And because it turns them on and pushes buttons they like to have, their conspiracy buttons that they like, you know, they just buy into it. And that's their conclusion. But that's not what I found when I looked at the man. Man, it's not. Likewise with Hecate, I do not find Hecate to be frightening, dark, or bothersome at all. I find her kind of fascinating.
And the author you worked with there, I mean, he was writing about Crowley's work for England during World War II, correct?
Yeah, and he writes about some of this very trip I'm talking about. That's why I read his book, because I needed to learn more about the stops that Crowley made along the way. Because by that time I had suspected, you know, what did Crowley know about this? What might have been his role in it, if any at all? And of course, I finally came to the conclusion that he had no role in it. And like I said a moment ago, I think he was aware of it, and I had to, you know, do the background, you know, that led to that conclusion. And Rick's book, Secret Agent 666, is an excellent book on that. It also involves the Crowley and the Lusitania, so it's an excellent source for anyone interested.
Remind me what the Lusitania is.
The Lusitania on the 7th of May, 1915, was struck by a German torpedo and went down off the coast of Ireland. Okay. And there is some weird stuff with it that we talk about in Empire of the Wheel, the first one, in one of the later chapters. It's one of the first hints of there's definitely something weird going on here, you know?
Okay.
In the big picture, weird. There's something weird going on from the beginning, you know, in the local aspect of the mystery. And, you know, another figure, another character in this mystery, and this blew my mind when I was first reading this in, you know, the newspaper accounts after Ann Walker suggested I go look into this Cora Stanton mystery. When Cora Stanton, who I believed to be at a place, was buried, and she's buried here in San Bernardino. In fact, I go visit her gravesite every year on the anniversary of her death, and I'll be going here about another week or so. And, of course, she's buried under the name Cora Stanton. I'm convinced those are the remains of Etta Place. Anyway, the minister that officiated at her very public funeral, by the way. This was a huge mystery in its day. That's also, you know, when you read the book, you'll see what a huge mystery this whole Cora Stanton thing was at the time it was happening. Okay? Now she's judged to be a suicide, and yet the Episcopal minister in town gives her a very public funeral. Now you got to understand something. In 1915, and I've confirmed this with theologians and church history experts, okay? I went to the LA Diocese office, which San Bernardino falls under, and looked at the historical actual records, you know, locally here at the time and stuff. In 1915, a suicide would never have been given a public funeral. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this was a funeral was attended by hundreds of people. Okay. And was reported in the newspapers and stuff. And yet that Episcopal minister, still gave her a very public funeral. And then within, I think, 2 weeks, he and his wife packed up their things and left San Bernardino. Huh. And here's what's interesting. Let me add that among the suspects in this 1915 mystery would be members of the local spiritualist church. Okay. The spiritualist group with a capital S. Okay. And spiritualism, of course, was big. And one of the biggest spiritualist temples in the state of California, the first one, was here in San Bernardino. Now they were a very active group here in San Bernardino at the time this was going on, and the book goes into why I suspect some of their members were involved with these murders. Okay, now think spiritualists with the capital S. Let's go back to that minister, 1915. Okay, packs his bags and leaves. That minister was left the San Bernardino church to go back east to Boston, where he became the assistant director of the American Psychical Research Association. That minister was the Reverend Dr. Walter Franklin Prince. I want you to think about something, because in the decade following this weird mystery here in San Bernardino, where Walter Franklin Prince was the minister that gave the suicide a very public funeral, okay? A mystery wherein I suspect spiritualists, Walter Franklin Prince, in the following decade after leaving San Bernardino, within days of this mystery happening, he teams up with Harry Houdini very famously to go after corrupt spiritualists. What I suggest and speculate in the book and stand by to this day is that Prince got his first nasty taste of these spiritualists, these corrupt ones, here in San Bernardino with this whole Cora Stanton mystery. I suspect that Prince knew there was something bad involved with these mysterious deaths. I think he suspected they were murders as well. And whatever he knew about what happened here in San Bernardino, whatever happened, I think that kind of fueled his fire against the corrupt spiritualists, in the following decade. And here's another little tidbit about that. Harry Houdini was in California and performing in Los Angeles in late November of 1915 when this stuff was going on. And so, you know, it's little things like that make you really go, wow, what the heck is going on here? Prince turns up in the middle of all of this. You know, make of it what you will, I say to the reader.
Well, yeah. So would they today, do you think there's a secret space program type of thing going on?
Oh, okay. We're leaping to that.
We're going
to
jump forward for a moment.
Okay. I personally think the United States began its secret space program in 1947 with Roswell.
Really?
I go into this in Shimmering Light. I pretty much lay it out there. I propose that the big dark secret about Roswell is that in 1947, right there in New Mexico, you had the greatest German rocket scientist that America had possession of, okay? And you had a U.S. Air Force pursuing what we call aerospace medicine. In other words, how to keep pilots alive at high altitude. Well, what is outer space but high altitude, okay? Yeah. You have them with all sorts of resources here at the end of World War II. You got these guys, they're working under secret conditions, right? Out there in the middle of the desert. Now, when you have guys who, this group of guys over here is working on keeping pilots alive at high altitude. These are the guys who would go on to develop life support systems later, okay? And they're right next door to the guys that are the rocket engineers. Are you telling me that these groups didn't get together and think, hey, we have permission to work on life support systems. You guys have the permission to do these rockets and get them, you know, to, if you want to try shooting one in space, do it. Why don't we put a life support system in one of these rockets and put some guys and shoot them into space and see if this will work? I argue that that's what happened with Roswell. That all this stuff about the aliens and the little bodies might have just, you know, it just blew up out of that initial radio report where, oh, it's a flying saucer, because they didn't want to say it was a first classified attempt at manned spaceflight. Hmm. Now, some people are going to say, Walter, you're nuts. I'm used to that. But when you really honestly look at the historical context and what I just laid out there, and you can honestly just dismiss what I just laid out, you're being stubborn and blind. And so I think that's possibly, very possibly, what Roswell was. Now, whether that's what Roswell was or not, you still had the United States Air Force in the 50s, aerospace medicine in particular, tasked with the first manned space program. A lot of people don't know this. Mercury was an Air Force program before NASA was even created. And then they stood up and founded NASA, and they said, okay, Mercury, NASA, you'll take Mercury now. What they don't tell us is the Air Force was never necessarily told to stop. We're just told that NASA took over Mercury. But right. We have no way to assume that the Air Force was told to stop developing manned spaceflight programs. So what I argue is what you had at that time, this is my speculation, folks, what you had at that time within that context was, while NASA was developing what we know from the history books and the films and stuff, the Air Force was doing pretty much the same thing, parallel but classified. I would venture to say that what NASA put into Mercury in their public program to make happen, a lot of that they probably got from the Air Force developing their classified manned space program, you know. And I think the progression continued mostly parallel until, you know, at some point, whether that was in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, at some point where then, you know, the classified stuff really took off, and what they would have today would be beyond NASA, of course, maybe not Star Trek, okay? I like when somebody proposes that, you know, a spaceship today, interplanetary, let's just say interplanetary, would be very similar to a naval submarine. You know, it makes sense, right? It's in a hostile environment underwater. Well, you do a similar format, you know, just up in space. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a secret U.S. military space program going on that has nothing to do with the breakaway civilizations and what they might have developed.
And what do you think the difference there would be?
I think it's very possible that the breakaways would be more advanced because, you know, they're breakaways. They don't have the oversight. They don't have to figure out how to hide their budget and stuff. They can just, they don't have to worry about getting approvals based on, you know, is it nice to monkeys or is it going to give, you know, the pilot a headache or bad dreams. You know, they can just do whatever they want and just go full bore, and they can experiment, you know, with all sorts of alternative technologies. And maybe those alternative technologies can be advanced exponentially farther than the technologies, you know, our military was made to work with, right? So it's all speculation. Yes. There could be no secret space program. There could be no breakaway civilizations. It could be all fantasy. I don't think so.
where would the core of these breakaway civilizations be?
Well, what do you mean? Like where would you find their headquarters, so to speak? I think the nature of them is such. I think the German one, the NIMSA one, is right here on Earth in the various military industrial complexes of the powerful nations. Because in the military industrial complex, what you have is an example of the classic German model by is it Schacht? I apologize. I'm doing a brain dump on the guy's name, the World War II era guy that learned that what Germany could do would be to develop its model of industrialism in another country and in effect make that country's industry a colony of Germany, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's what they've done with, I think that's what the Nazi International, so to speak, version of the NIMSA has done to the United States post-World War II with our military-industrial complex. I think that's what Eisenhower was warning us about. They have turned the post-World War II United States into a colony of post-war Nazi International. Now, I'm not the first guy to say something like that, but yeah. I've become more convinced of that because of this very question. You know, you're asking. Now, that's the NIMSA side. The other breakaway organization that I'm talking about, they could be doing a very similar thing where if you look close enough and knew where to look, you could see their presence in the various industries that they would need, of course. However, it's very possible, and again, go back to what I said about, you know, they kind of were away, so to speak. It's very possible that they could be off planet. And I say that reluctantly because that can inspire wild ideas. But, you know, they could be the guys on the moon that were told, you know, that the Apollo 11 guys allegedly saw out on that. Right. Ledge, okay. They could be, well, there's a very specific reason I go into in my book Origin as to why they could be on Mars.
You want to go into that?
Yeah, it's a bit fantastical.
That's all right.
It is a speculation, but it's right there. It's the reason why I give the name of this breakaway, number two. I call it the 1903, because there is a legend that in 1903, Nikola Tesla had been asked to build an airship for a group to travel to Mars, or he was allegedly involved with the building of this airship that this crazy group of guys wanted to fly to Mars, and they took off and they went into space allegedly and, of course, never returned. And then we have Tesla later talking about getting weird communications that he thought came from Mars.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people have said, ooh, aliens. But there's a young researcher named Jonathan Batista who posed to me the question, hey, Walter, what if that communication that Tesla was talking about was your 1903 group finally making contact? And I thought, wow, Jonathan, I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting. So, you know, that's the basics of it. And I admit that's just, some people are just not even going to want to hear about it. But, you know, it's there. What are we to think of it? Look at the weird stuff that, you know, now we're finding out about Mars and what might really be up there. And when did we know what we know? You know, how did we know about Mars and when did we know it? The things we know and when did we know it kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, so in reflection, maybe there could be something to it. But I admit it's very thin. But one of the strongest reasons why I do think there is another breakaway that is a rival to the NIMSA is this. These NIMSA guys, they're the essentially the behind the Nazi International. These are globalist totalitarians, okay? Mm-hmm. If they did not have some force equal or greater to them resisting them, this world we live in would be a much darker, terrible place than it is. Because I think that the NIMSA group, this German Nazi NIMSA International breakaway, I think they would just be ruling openly. But somebody has opposed them with equal threat, equal force. There's somebody out there that's able to stand up to them. And I think that's this other breakaway.
Huh. Okay, fair enough. And stuff like that, I always find it fascinating to speculate about stuff like that.
And admittedly, yes, these of course are speculations. They have to be, you know, until we see otherwise.
Yeah. Okay. Let's jump back again, and let's look at you did some connections here with Lovecraft as well, didn't you?
Oh boy, yes. Well, what I learned was that, you know, of course you have the Lovecraft and Houdini connection.
Right.
You've got the Lovecraft and Crowley connection, you know. With the
is there a Lovecraft and Crowley connection?
Oh my goodness, yes. You've got in 1907, I think it is, I'd have to pull it up, you've got Crowley writing in his books about these psychic visions that certain people are having about this being that is asleep in a sepulcher at the bottom of the sea, and he's mm-hmm. tentacled, and the name Tutulu is involved. Okay.
Right.
Then of course, a few years later, you've got Lovecraft, and you know, essentially what Crowley wrote is a description of, you know, Cthulhu. Okay, if you're familiar with the story, Call of Cthulhu. So clearly, Lovecraft, you know, was familiar with either the same information that Crowley had, or he was familiar directly with Crowley's writings. There's a big question about, well, wow, did they ever meet when, you know, in the years when Lovecraft was in New York and such, and apparently there's no direct evidence for it, on and on and so forth. So, you know, I'm looking at, you know, you've got Houdini, who's in Southern California during this 1915 mystery. You got Crowley, who passed through San Bernardino during the mystery. And here you have Lovecraft tied to both these guys. Well, golly, was there any kind of Lovecraft connection at all to San Bernardino Valley in the early 20th century? And oh boy, I found one. And there was a writer named Clifford Eddy, who was a friend of Lovecraft. He and his wife were friends of Lovecraft. And in fact, his wife even wrote a book about Lovecraft and her husband's friendship with him. And I spoke directly to their grandson, and he provided me with the information. Clifford Eddy's wife, when she was a girl, a youth, lived and went to school right here in Redlands. Now, Redlands is the town where two of the 1915 victims were living and were killed. So she was here. It was a few years before, but she was here, and her family was still living in California, up in Northern California, I think, in 1915. So what does that mean? Well, that suggests that, okay, we know Lovecraft, you know, has some weird writings that jibe directly with stuff Crowley wrote, and we know Crowley was here. We know Lovecraft and Houdini had a direct connection, and we know Houdini's connection to, you know, Walter Franklin Prince, and he was here, and Houdini was in Southern California here in 1915. And now we have the wife, who herself was also good friends with Lovecraft, you know, who was in this area, and, you know, I argue, of course, that, you know, the spiritualists were here, and this place was a weird place before what happened in the second half of 1915. I think that Lovecraft learned some general things about the San Bernardino Valley from Clifford Eddy's wife, Muriel Eddy, that certainly would have flavored whatever knowledge he had of this area and the weird things that go on here. Now, Lovecraft also was kind of a literary mentor to Robert H. Barlow, who became a respected archaeologist, specifically of, you know, ancient Mexico and native cultures. Now, Barlow would have been a contemporary of, and certainly knowledgeable of, maybe even a student of, the works of John Peabody Harrington. Okay, who's Harrington? John Peabody Harrington was a very eccentric fellow who was a legendary anthropologist who came here to the Inland Empire to study, live with, and study firsthand the ancient myths and the lost languages of the tribes of Native Americans here in the San Bernardino Valley. Okay? Hmm. And he was probably the most prolific American anthropologist in history. And he got into the mythologies, the weird dark tales and the lost languages. It's generally regarded that Harrington was on to something very ancient and, you know, mysterious in the knowledge that he was gleaning from these. And these experiences living with these native tribes. And he was very protective of what he was doing. He would even avoid getting his paycheck just to avoid when the Smithsonian would send someone out to, you know, kind of get a report on what he was doing. He just wouldn't tell them what he was doing. Hmm. So Barlow, Robert H. Barlow, I think probably might have even have learned first about Harrington from Lovecraft, because Lovecraft was interested in these kinds of things. And Cthulhu takes place in the Pacific, and right. Lovecraft had an interest in what was going on out here, you know, in the ancient West Coast, ancient California and stuff. So I speculate that because we know that Lovecraft was definitely an influence on Barlow and his professional pursuits as he grew up. I suggest that Lovecraft was definitely an influence on him to become an archaeologist, and Lovecraft might be the one that introduced Barlow to Harrington. But even if he didn't, Barlow definitely would have learned about and studied Harrington during his own education and his own career. And Barlow, of course, came to an ignominious end. You know, we're told he committed suicide, and it was in Mexico City. He also came to visit. This was after Lovecraft had died. Barlow became the executor of Lovecraft's literary estate when Lovecraft died. That's how much Lovecraft highly, you know, respected and regarded.
Now he was really young, right?
Yes. Yeah. He was when Lovecraft would go visit him, he'd go visit the whole family, the mom, the dad, and I go into this in a couple of books. I go into this in Empire of the Wheel 3, The Nameless Ones, and a bit in the Bierce book that I did, Secret Missions 3.
Okay.
So you've got, as you can see, I'm wandering into thread territory, right? You can see that what we've got here is this fabric with all these rich threads in it. And what really started for me as just a simple, you know, Ann Walker, a local librarian telling me a ghost story and go check out a newspaper account, right? I thought it was just a local mystery. And look what pulling the threads just kept leading to.
Yeah. That's
and I have not even gone into in our conversation the weird stuff I was experiencing personally, synchronicity-wise and phenomenon-wise. And I don't go into that in the books. I won't. The books are about the academic part of the mystery and what I can present in some way as evidence or sources to back it up. This was an ordeal, okay? And that still continues to impact my life to this day. This was something.
Well, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, synchronicity in itself. You know, when you see a film like A Beautiful Mind, when you see, not that I'm a genius like that guy, I'm not trying to imply that, but when you see, you know, in that story, what happened to him just with his exposure to his understanding of that higher level complex mathematics. Mm-hmm. When you then look at a dramatic presentation like that film, The Number 23, that Jim Carrey did, and you know, everybody, most of your listeners, I'm sure, are real familiar with all the weird 23 phenomena. It's in that category. When you start looking at this Empire of the Wheel thing, and particularly when, you know, Hecate became involved in this early on, in her guise as Saint Catherine of Alexandria. You see, there is no such thing. There was no historical Saint Catherine of Alexandria. She is a syncretic saint. She was created by the Catholic Church because they knew they couldn't get rid of Hecate worship. Saint Catherine of Alexandria, they stole a part of the bio of Hypatia of Alexandria, okay, who was a historical woman, of course. And, you know, you can look her up, and so they stole from that bio, they Catholiced it up, and, they even gave St. Catherine of Alexandria the same symbol as Hecate. She is Catherine of the Wheel. Mm. And the wheel, the very specific wheel they use, is the exact same wheel that you usually see associated with Hecate. They couldn't be more obvious. Okay. Now here's what's interesting. Here's what really was a big discovery that, again, you ask why Hecate. Okay. In Riverside, California, here, which is part of the Inland Empire, one of the first things when I was researching the citrus industry history here is the parent navel orange tree, the very first navel orange tree in the United States, was a gift from Brazil to Riverside, California. And it still grows to this day. Every navel orange tree, be it in California or Florida, got its the little genetics thing they do, its sprig or whatever, seed or whatever, from that orange tree that you can go see in Riverside. They got a little fence around it and stuff. Now, up the street, excuse me, half a block is the Church of St. Catherine of the Wheel, St. Catherine of Alexandria. So there you have St. Catherine of Alexandria and her wheel at her feet, essentially a statue of Hecate, within visual sighting of this parent navel orange tree. Now, remember what I said about some of the reasons for why they would have done all these rituals, that agriculture was involved, very specifically the citrus industry. Uh-huh. Okay, so there's that. Now, when you're in downtown Riverside, there's the original courthouse, okay? And on the corner, on one corner of the front of the courthouse, you have a Grecian image, Grecian images of three female figures, one standing and two kind of kneeling, all right? Now, what did I say before about Hecate? She's a triple aspect goddess. Maiden, mother, crone is how the witches look at her, okay? So here you have on the corner of this court building three female figures, right? What is that? That's Hecate in her triple aspect, maiden, mother, crone, okay? Now, to put an emphasis on it, at her feet is the wheel. the Hecate wheel. Okay. Now, on no other corner of that courthouse is this same configuration with the wheel. It's only on that corner. And that corner of that building happens to look out on an intersection where my geomorphology guy that does my telluric current research identified an intersection of telluric current. Now, here's what's interesting. He told me about that intersection when I was doing the original investigation in 2011, but it was a couple of years before I discovered that what I consider that image of Hecate on the corner of that building looking straight down on the intersection of that telluric current. Now, why is that important? Because Hecate is also known as the goddess of the triple crossroad, a crossroad. Telluric current associated with ley lines. Ley lines are often associated with roads, okay? It's a crossroad. An intersection of telluric current or ley line is a crossroad. And there you have the goddess of the crossroad looking down on the crossroad of this energy. There's a little more there to it, but it's in the book. I got to leave something. So I consider this to be openly a Hecate shrine, essentially. Mm. Now, here's what's interesting. I said it was the old courthouse, right?
Yeah.
The year that that courthouse was built happens to be 1903. So this is an example of synchronicity. I'm not saying that the breakaway civilization I call the 1903 built that courthouse. Okay? But isn't it interesting that out of all the years, not 1902, not 1904, not 1911, not 1897, 1903. Hmm. And that's just, you know, the weird, oh, isn't that interesting? Oh, look, Hecate is all over the place. Now, again, there's the Zodiac Killer connection to all of this, which is in there. But and there's a lot of Hecate stuff there that I have presented to the world of Zodiac conspiracy folks. Mm-hmm. And the regular folks out there found it fascinating, but the guys who see themselves as the Zodiac experts don't want to hear it. They ignore what I've pointed out that even incorporates some of the evidence they've put out there, because they're married to the idea of there was one guy who did it and we can still catch it, which I think is ridiculous.
Really?
They're not going to catch. I mean, too many years have passed there. And I don't think it was just one guy. I suspect it was a group of people.
Fair enough.
Yeah. You know, you have age discrepancy in the description by witnesses, and a variety of things. But there's definitely Hecate symbolism in the Zodiac Killer things. And one of the famous Zodiac Killer victims pre-Bay Area was right there in Riverside, California in the 60s, Sherry Jo Bates, who he murdered on the campus of the Riverside Community College. And I've been to the actual spot there, and the telluric current line runs right through it from that intersection that I described that the Hecate statue is looking down upon from the courthouse. So you see, you pull the thread and it legitimately leads to another. Now, what you conclude about that is your own.
Right.
It can't be denied that I have pointed out the Hecate symbolism in the Zodiac Killer killings. I've pointed out, you know, the presence of Hecate in Riverside. We know Zodiac killed someone in Riverside. These are facts. These are realities. This is not stuff I'm making up. My conclusions, I admit, are my own.
Sure.
You know, and I tell the reader and the listener, make your own conclusions, you know, but don't dismiss mine because, you know.
Yeah, no.
They're a lot more substantial than some people want to admit.
So I guess what we'll conclude on here is when we go back to the beginning and these murders that happened in a ritual for Hecate, what were they trying to do? What was the point of the ritual?
If it had to do with what I said before about the Panama Canal and such, it was somebody's insane plan to infuse the agricultural industry in the area with magic, using, you know, magic to give them prosperity.
Okay.
It's also possible that the opening of the Panama Canal might have been the bringing together of the of what they believed, what they perceived was some type of magical, with a K, magical powers of this telluric energy. They could finally join them through the opening of the Panama Canal from the east and from the west. They could finally come together through the canal. This is a theory as to what, you know, one of the motives may have been. The other more nefarious things are that, and again, I lay this out, I go into this more in Empire of the Wheel 3, but I talk about a little bit in Empire of the Wheel 1, of course, is that what they were trying to do was a resonant act of black magic that would reload itself on a timetable geared in Hecate veneration every 50 years. You know, you might open a cycle, and then Hecate, often venerated in, sometimes venerated in 100 years in 250s, okay?
Right.
You would open a veneration or operation, and then 50 years later you would have something, you know, happen, and then 50 years after that you would close that cycle, you know, theoretically. This is my theory. Yeah. Or you just open it, and every 50 years, give or take thereabouts, something occurs that it's kind of on autopilot. And I lay out in the book what I think the 50-year events might have been, and what the 100-year event, of course,
right,
and what other offshoot related things are. What's interesting is I had gone forward with this, and then I said, well, what happened 50 years before 1915? And of course that's 1865. And then I thought, oh boy, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And we know the weird synchronicities between Lincoln and Kennedy and their assassinations. And I see the Kennedy assassination as one of the resonating acts of Hecate magic in, you know, the big picture of this Empire of the Wheel thing. And there we have Lincoln 50 years before what happened in San Bernardino. So, wow, when did this thing really start? That's part of the weirdness, is when you kind of do that analysis. And admittedly, I mean, you know, some people could go crazy with this stuff. You got to try to keep your sense of humor, and you got to know when to back away. I mean, right. But you know, if you want to get really weird, I mean, I was experiencing things like crows were suddenly, you know, spending a lot of time around my house. Actual crows, not blackbirds. I know the difference between a crow and a raven, you know, and a blackbird. Mm-hmm. And these were big old ravens, okay? And doing interesting things, like tap, tap, tapping at my skylight window to get my attention and things. Strange haunting type phenomena started to emerge and go on, and other people witnessed it with me. It wasn't just me by myself. And now I got to tell you this story about a really, honestly, guys, no, there were other people that would say, what is that? I go, oh, thank you. Thank you very much. You hear that too? Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, and I mean, it would take forever to go into that stuff, and some stuff I just, you know, don't like to, in a public forum, go into it, because, you know, there's this, the goddess Isis is associated with Hecate, you know, is considered one of the, by many, considered to be one of the faces of Hecate. And there's this thing called the Admonition of Isis. It's in, you can see an illustration of it in Manly P. Hall's Secret Teaching of the Ages. And it's basically, you know, when Isis or Isis slash Hecate lifts her veil to show you her true nature, she simply tells you, asks you to tell no one. There are certain things that when you look, I spent some years investigating this, and I've written three books about it. I've really taken a close look at Hecate. And if you do this, be prepared, because she looks back. And she says hello. And it can be pretty spooky at times.
I'm sure.
You know, to go beyond that is stuff that most people are just not going to want to believe. So I don't like to cast the pearls in the wrong direction.
Sure.
You know, I admit it. My closest friends know the stories. I was followed from my home when I was during the time I was investigating this stuff, followed around my neighborhood.
Really?
Yeah, I was also brought before a guy who, you know, his family's been, was probably here in San Bernardino at that time, and it was pretty much made clear to me that they had been watching me.
Huh.
Yeah, and it was interesting. And, you know, so I had a weird, very weird, hostile reaction from the coroner's office here. I mean, I'm asking for information, something that happened 100 years ago, and right. They're hostile. It was real interesting. Yeah, that's just some of it, but not all of it. And, you know, I figured, well, I got these three books and a bunch of interesting threads to pull, and
wow. So where can people get the books?
The books are available only at lulu.com and print on demand. Yeah, you got to wait for, you know, 5 or 10 days to get it, but it's worth it because you get a physical book in your hand and, you know, something to hold and read and, you know, lulu.com.
Okay.
I have an author's page there. You can also get my fiction there if you're interested in that. It's pulp, fun, edgy, racy stuff. So.
And as far as news on what you're doing, you have a blog?
I have a blog that sometimes I'm real active on it. Other times I go a long time with it, but it's something I do keep active. It's empireofthewheel.blogspot.com. If you've never been there, I'm sure there's some things that, particularly after tonight's conversation, that, you know, you'll be interested in reading, because there's, you know, some stuff to augment what we've been talking about.
Right.
Yeah, so the book's at Lulu and empirethewheel.blogspot.com. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook. My stuff there is not a constant stream of details about my research. You know, you can get, if you got a question you want to ask me, you know, you can reach out and ask me there and stuff. And, you know, I'm presently looking into a couple of things which will probably result in a book. But I'm in the research phase on a couple of things right now, a phase I like very much.
Okay, great. Well, we will have you back probably to talk about your latest book, since we didn't get into that at all about Ambrose Bierce. And, yeah, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope it's interesting to your listeners. I hope I'm not a disappointment.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that. Walter will be back sometime soon, and we're going to be talking about his new book on Ambrose Bierce, as well as filling out more of this very extensive story. I know a few people said it was a little hard to follow, but that's because there's a lot of stuff here, and this is the first time I've had him on. So think of this as kind of laying a rough foundation, and we'll have him back to elaborate some more, or just go pick up his books. And if you want to hear more, become a patron. There was about a 20-minute outtake afterwards where we talk about Tom DeLonge and the airships of the 1897 airship wave. Two different subjects for patrons only. So $3 to be a patron. Go check it out. WhereDidTheRoadGo.com. To take you out tonight, we're going to end with Whirring World from Psyche Corporation, which was the song that I used to always end the show with until I started kind of expanding out and picking up other independent music to end with. But I feel like it's a perfect ending for tonight's show. So here you go, Whirring World. See you next time.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that bugs my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world. Of the universe, ventricles and tetrahead, chambers number 1597, and counting, and counting. Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world. Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world. Can you hear?
You have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.